I'm recording it. Okay. Okay. Right, I'm recording it. When studying anything, we have to know, whether it's a Jewish source or a secular source, really when a person begins studying any field of knowledge whatsoever, it's very important to know what really is the most important thing to bear in mind, the most important thing to always remember when studying that particular field of knowledge. And I'm talking about really anything. It could be reading a poem, it could be reading philosophy, it could be studying science, anything, anytime you engage upon a field of study, Judaism, secular, the most important thing to bear in mind, and the most frequently forgotten, because it's the hardest, is one word, context. Context. Everything has to be taken into context. Context of when it was said, how it was said, to whom it was said, who wrote it, why he wrote it, what made him write it, what motivated him to write it, what circumstances were that caused him to write it. So and not, it's sociologically for sure, sociologically, psychologically, but again, if you study anything in the humanities, and even if you study science, one of the reasons that we have such a hard time with being able to figure out what's going on even empirically in the scientific world is because we have a lack of context in so many things. That's, by the way, parenthetically, that's why being judgmental is stupid. I personally have an allergy to judgmental people. I am allergic to judgmental people. Judgmentalism is the most ridiculous thing possible. Why? Because of that same idea of context. Chazal said, "Al todun es chavercha ad shetagilim koimai." Do not judge your friend, even if he's not your friend. Chazal didn't mean he has to be your buddy. Even though Chazal are using the word chavercha, they don't mean your buddy. "Al todun es chavercha shetagilim koimai." Don't judge another person until you're in their place. Is why? What are Chazal essentially saying? Context. Imagine seeing, you know, you have a headline and not reading the whole article. I'm sure many of us have done that, right? You have a headline, you don't read the whole article. There's no way to really know what's being conveyed over here. You have to see a full picture. And therefore you understand also that whenever you want to be aware of the way that we think, not just studying a field of research, not just studying a field of knowledge, when we talk about our particular mode of thinking, so, you know, we seem to think that we're free people, right? We're free people. We have our own ways to think. We have our own, you know, freedom of speech. A person could think whatever we want, and we're our own people. There's actually a wonderful book, if we speak about sociology and psychology, you've all heard of the famous psychologist Eric Fromm. Eric Fromm has a book called Escape from Freedom, where he actually writes that we think that because of freedom of speech that we become truly free. That we really are have a complete freedom of what we are, who we are, what we want to be. He writes, it's not true. The opposite. There's such a complete, constant bombardment of other people's opinions, it's almost impossible to really know what you yourself think anymore. And that was before, iPhones. That's 50 years ago. More of it, right? There's such a constant bombardment of other people's opinions because of freedom of speech and because of technology. There's no way to really know what I think, to really decide what I want to do, what I think, what I really believe inside. You know, in his time already, he said, Shakespeare said, "To this, thus above all, to thine own self be true," right? To be true to oneself, to know what I really feel, what I really think, is almost impossible today. You have to go like in a desert island for a couple of weeks to start hearing something. And therefore, we have to remember that even when it comes to ourselves, we have to remember context. That when we think certain ways, when we embark in trying to feel what we think, we have to remember context, that we're slaves. We're subjugated to the context of the society that we're living in and the culture that we're living in. Just give you an example. And this is related to halachic man. I'm going to tie back to how we finished last week. I actually just saw something very interesting. A couple of weeks ago. Everyone understands that you cannot possibly begin to fathom who we are, our society. And I mean whether you're Jewish or Gentile, it doesn't matter. Wherever you are. Today, We are products of the 60s. We all agree with that? There's not, as frum as you want to be, as ultra, ultra, ultra orthodox, ultra to the 15th power, everyone today is at some level receiving from what happened in the 60s. And I saw an article, listen to this, that if you look, if you're one of those, if you look at the movies from the 50s, right, from the 50s and the late 60s and 70s, the difference is, it's not just like, you know, from the Victorian era till today. From the Victorian era to the 60s is closer than from before this, from after the 60s to before the 60s. Somebody sent an article that if you look just at the actors in the 50s, the actors, how stiff they are. How stiff, how not natural they are. That when they say things, like there's a complete lack of being natural. Like their body movements are complete, are calculated, barely moving. And it's like when they're speaking, it's like it's not like vivid today with the realism of today. It's completely calculated, and there's almost a stiffness to the movement. And this person wrote, this article that he wrote, that it'd be interesting to know if that's how people really were in the 50s or just the actors. There's no way to really know. There's no way to know really. Were people like that? Were people much more inhibited, that they didn't move around so much? Because what happened in the 60s brought about a general revolution and a complete breaking forward, breaking down of so many barriers of inhibitions. And that trickles down in so many different ways of context. And therefore, bearing in mind the idea of context, we have to approach what we've left off last week, what Rav Soloveitchik is beginning to say over here, when he speaks about the three types of men. We mentioned last week that he began right away with that halachic man is a hybrid. Halachic man is a fusion, that there's a tension. Halachic man is reflects two opposing selves, disparate images, right? Right away with that tension. That the halachic man has this tension that he's dealing with the bipolar, I don't want to say disorder, right? But this bipolar pull, the struggle of, on one hand, homoreligiosus, religious man, and cognitive man, scientific man. And I told you last week that when we speak about these two men, that halachic man is going to be a mixture of, but let's focus today on religious man, now, religious man and scientific man, we must bear in mind the right context, how to look at those two types of people. When Rav Soloveitchik is writing a book talking about and comparing scientific man, cognitive man, and homo religiosus, religious man, he is not speaking about in context of the way that today most people interpret and explain the quote-unquote debate and struggle between science and religion. That's not what he means. And it's very important to understand that, first of all, to understand what Rav Soloveitchik is going to write over here, but even more important, to be able to understand why there are so many people that are confused today. There are so many people, I mentioned last week, and one person told me after the shiur, that he said that they interviewed most people today that leave religion, as they say the reason is because of science, right? That the science is this big monster that is somehow getting people, is having a crusade against religion. So I want you, we have to talk about something very important, and this is going to be relevant to a lot of the things of Soloveitchik. This is it's what we spoke about to be able to understand the text, and many of the things that we're going to be discussing later on. Seriously, I would probably say the main theme of the book, which we really only get to in chapter 5. Chapter 5 is where the punchline is. We'll probably get there, Mitzvah Shem, by Rosh Hashanah or something, I hope. But in chapter 5 is where he gets to. The punchline is going to be very much a elaboration of what we're about to discuss now. To be able to understand the context of what today in modern society is perceived as a struggle and a tension, a debate, a fight to the death between science and religion is coming from the context of one book. One book. Probably one of the most important historically, obviously, I don't agree with what it says in the book, none of us do, but historically, this book had an effect on really forging Western civilization as we know it throughout history, philosophical history and history of thought. And that book is a book that was written at the beginning of the 5th century by a man called Augustine of Hippo. Augustine. The Christians refer to him as Saint Augustine. Augustine of Hippo wrote a book called City of God. And like I said at the very beginning, there are so many people that don't like to put things in context that many people never even heard of that book. And people don't realize that all that we discuss in today's society, in debates and everything, you have to understand, things are not born in a vacuum. Thought is not born in a vacuum. Human endeavor is never born in a vacuum. The way people think is not born in a vacuum. It's an evolution. And the evolution of Western civilization, what we have today, the way people think, including the 60s, all began with what Augustine of Hippo wrote in the book called City of God. That book, City of God, was actually a psak halacha of a machlekes between Plato and Aristotle. But we'll get to that afterwards. First, let's talk about the book, City of God, and then we have to see how that actually comes as a result from what was said 700 years before by Plato and Aristotle, and then we could put that into perspective and really understand why people think science and religion are at each other's throats. So the book, City of God, was written in the year 410 CE. So you all know, just to put things in context, in a historical perspective, the year 325 CE is when Constantine, the emperor, at that time the Roman Empire had not yet split into West and East. At that time the Pax Romana had lasted for a couple of centuries, there was peace, the Roman Empire ruled the world, and came along Constantine, who only later his children are the ones that separated into East and West. So the whole known world at the time was under his power. And he, in order what he believed would be to unify, to forge the empire, would be this new religion, Christianity, he converted to Christianity. And then became a whole series of ecumenical councils where they forged and they, what exactly is Christianity? They had all these different votes, you know. It's very interesting. Stand parenthetically, I always like to point this out, that in 325, when Constantine formed the first ecumenical council in a city called Nicaea, today, Orthodox Christianity espouses what's called the Nicene Creed, which was formulated in the city of Nicaea, 325 CE. You know what the council was about? They convened because there was a debate whether Jesus, the historical figure of Jesus, was divine or not. They took a vote. I kid you not. They took a vote. They voted whether he was divine or not. And it was his lucky day. And the majority ruled that he was, and that became the Nicene Creed, and that became orthodoxy against the Arian heresy. So the Christianity began in was forged as the state religion in the year 325 CE. For a couple of decades after that is a very interesting history of there were emperors that were Christian and emperors that were pagan, and there was a whole bit to do until finally the year 380 CE, the emperor passed as law Christian orthodoxy, and the whole empire took upon one religion. It was what he began in 325, finished in the year 380 CE. And there was much jubilation and celebrating. By the way, what I'm saying now is relevant to our daily lives. This is not a history lesson. Context. There was much celebrating, there was much jubilation. Everyone was very happy. The Christians were happy. The priests were ecstatic. 30 years later, in the year 410, Rome was sacked by barbarians. The Visigoths, a barbaric tribe, came and sacked Rome. Rome fell for the first time in over 800 years. The eternal city, the imperial city, the seat of Christianity, fell to barbarians. It was sacked. And to try to understand the trauma, it's like, you know, imagine like, you know, they have these movies that the terrorists take over the White House, right? That's what it was like, that the barbarians came and sacked Rome. The famous, there was such trauma, they said, the city which had taken the world was taken. The city which had taken the world was taken. Or as one famous person wrote at that time, if Rome can perish, what possibly can be safe? It was a traumatic experience. And what do you think people were saying at the time? This was 30 years after Christianity became the official religion. This was 30 years after Christianity became Rome. So what people began saying is, oh, for hundreds of years, the pagan gods were watching Rome. Hundreds of years, Rome was pagan and they were ruling the world. 30 years after it became Christian, it fell. And it became very traumatic. It was a terrible blow to Christians throughout the world. Came along Augustine of Hippo. And he wrote a book called City of God. And it can't be overstressed how much this book shaped all of our reality. And in ways that we don't even know. The way that our minds were forged. Essentially, what he came to explain is as follows. Augustine wrote a book explaining that we have to know that it's true. Jerusalem is, Rome is Jerusalem, right? Rome is Jerusalem, in their opinion. And Jerusalem is the city of God. But the city of God is not in the physical world. That's city of man. He wrote a whole book establishing a complete split between city of man and city of God. The new Jerusalem is the city of God, which is an ethereal spiritual realm. It's true that JC came to the world, that the founder of Christianity came to the world to bring people to establish a Jerusalem, an eternal city. He came to the world to establish a city of God. But don't think that it meant on earth. No, there is a complete split between earth and heaven. By the way, I'm sure you all, it should be going through your minds already. You all remember what Chazal say, right? What did Chazal say? That Hashem swore. Chazal in the Medrash, which Augustine didn't see. This was in the Medrash. He didn't see this was written later. This was written later. I'm very curious to know if Chazal had in mind to dispute what Augustine was saying. But the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God swore that he wouldn't enter the supernal Jerusalem before he enters Yerushalayim Shel Mata. Right? But Augustine came and he wrote a book saying, no, there's two Jerusalems. Really? The founder of Christianity came to establish Jerusalem, which is a supernal, ethereal city. What goes on here on earth is irrelevant. That's not real. And he wrote a whole book explaining that. This conflict, this ultimate conflict between the spiritual and the physical. And that began also the whole ascetic journey of Christianity, which also had a lot of effect on a lot of Jewish writers throughout the Middle Ages. That one, in order to enter the city of God, one has to shun earthly pleasures. You cannot be a citizen of both city of God and the city of man. You have to choose. The city of God is this ethereal, supernal realm, this constant transcendent realm that one has to shun earthly pleasures and become a hermit to really take part in that city of God. And therefore, the fact that Rome fell down near this, that's city of man. That was the city of man. That wasn't real. That's not the real thing. The real thing is to aim for the city of God. That book did two things. Number one, it brought about the Dark Ages. Because essentially what happened after that book was that society, Western society, and again, Christianity, that book, he was one of the founding the church fathers. And his book and his philosophy circulated among the whole Western world. And then began a whole new thinking that there's no point in inquiring into the physical world. It's a waste of time. You don't have to know anything about physicality. He writes, Augustine. He writes that there's no longer any use to inquire into physics as the original is used to do. Who cares about physics? Who cares about the physical world? And that began the whole, all those, the teachers began researching and talking about theology. And theology, study of spirituality, that had absolutely nothing to do with the physical world. And that began the Dark Ages. A striving for the city of God, a giving up, a relinquishing, losing faith in city of man. And that brought about the Middle Ages. That's the first thing it did. The second thing it did is that when a couple of centuries later, people began again studying the world and looking at the world at the time of the Renaissance, when classical antiquity was revealed again, when they began studying again the original philosophers of the Greeks at the times of the Renaissance, and people began again seeing the inherent beauty in the world, etc., what was the psychology that people's was ingrained for almost 1,000 years already? Almost 1,000 years, it was ingrained in the mind of people that what? That the earthly realm and the spiritual realm, never the twain shall meet. You cannot be a citizen in both. And therefore, people began thinking that I have to either choose one or the other. Now, Augustine's philosophy was essentially a psak halacha. Augustine's philosophy, when he wrote The City of God, he very clearly was taking a side between a debate that happened 500 years, almost 600, 700 years before, between Plato and Aristotle. And we have to discuss this because it's going to be very relevant as we go further in the book. Rav Soloveitchik is going to make reference to it a lot of times, the debate between Plato and Aristotle. So you all know, Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. Plato was a student of Socrates, and he was the teacher of Aristotle. It's worthwhile, if you've never seen this, in order to better understand what we're going to learn today and speak about a lot. And by the way, the difference between Plato and Aristotle is found in the Svarma Kadoshim. If you look in our sources, the different schools, I've never seen it actually written clearly, but one could very clearly trace so many debates within the Jewish studies, with the way that we look at things, between that same debate, that there's almost these two realms of thought. One could even push, I'm sure the Rav would find a way to also show, that even Chassidim and Misnagdim are connected to it too. I'm sure he'll figure that out, he'll show it one of these days on Shavuos. So if you've never seen it, take a look when you get home, if you have access to it. There's a painting, one of the most famous paintings of the Renaissance, by the artist Raphael, known as The Academy. The Academy. Well, not now, don't whip out the smartphones now, you look at it later. This painting of Raphael called The Academy, is a very fits, from the Renaissance, I believe it was the 16th century. And not only is it a famous painting, because in my opinion, it's one of the most beautiful paintings, it's found in the Vatican, unfortunately, but I haven't seen the original, but it's not only important because it's a beautiful painting, but because, as I was saying, context, it also became very ingrained in people's mind that it cemented this debate. In the painting of The Academy, you have a picture of Plato's Academy, which was the first school where they actually taught philosophy. And you see Plato, the elder Plato, walking with his student, the younger Aristotle, walking together. And around them are all, you know, the philosophers, you know, like these half-naked guys lying on the floor, you know, just like staring into the sky, you know, eating grapes or whatever. And they're walking through, and Plato is pointing up, and Aristotle is pointing down. Now, to understand the context of their debate, it's actually very interesting. Plato was born into an aristocratic, wealthy family. And he was educated by his teachers. He was not part of regular, mundane, regular society. He was always an upper-class person. He then met the romantic Socrates. Socrates was anything but a part of civilization, right? The gadfly of Athens, Socrates did not believe in being normal. Socrates did not believe in being part of regular society, which is why they killed him. It was a pain in the neck. He was getting all the youth to be idealistic, to spend their lives, you know, trying to figure out and fathom the secrets of reality. So his whole background, Plato's whole background was sort of like aloof. Aristotle, on the other hand, grew up, his whole family were doctors. He came from a family of doctors. At that time, it wasn't like today, you know, Jewish doctors, all the Jewish mothers want their kids to be doctors. At that time, it was a very mundane profession. And Aristotle came from a very lowly family, a family of doctors. And even though Aristotle was a student of Plato, his philosophy was diametrically opposed to Plato. Now, we're going to begin talking about it today because, as I said, it's important. We're going to talk about it a lot as we go on because Rav Soloveitchik makes reference to it a lot. Plato's most famous, Plato, who is the father of idealism, all idealists, all those that believed in the prominence of the spiritual plane, that philosophically the spiritual is more important, or that the world itself is essentially spiritual, all idealists are students of Plato. All empiricists, those that believe that prominence, that focus has to be on the physical realm, are students of Aristotle. Plato's most famous philosophy is what's called the theory of ideas. The theory of ideas. And Aristotle's most famous philosophy, which Rav Soloveitchik actually writes already on the next page, on page 4, we're going to get to it. I'm sorry, on page 6 he brings it already over there. On page 6, if you take an idea in the middle of the page, he writes over there. So you see over there, in accordance with Aristotelian approach, the concept of lawfulness was identified the imminent theological process of the idea of the forms. The imminent, see on page 6, the imminent teleological process of the forms. In other words, Plato's idea of the ideas became imminent in the actual matter of the world. Let's understand very basically what that means, okay? Plato taught as follows. What is all of philosophy? The mind, the human intellect, is a flashlight to be able to see through the darkness of reality and come to contact with the truth of reality, which is not the world that we see. He actually gave a parable. It's probably the most famous parable in philosophy, which, by the way, the Mittler Rebbe writes this parable. The Mittler Rebbe writes it in Derech Chaim. I don't know if he saw it from Plato. And by the way, Stam, you know, Plato, the Rama already writes in Torah Sa'ila that Plato studied from Yirmiyahu HaNavi. You know that? It says that Plato met, it's historically, quite a few, I think the Barbanel already writes about it, that Plato met with Jeremiah, with Yirmiyah, the prophet, Yirmiyah, in Egypt. And they studied together. To the extent, listen to this, the Abarbanel writes, you all remember, what's the beginning of Yirmiyah? What's the second pasuk in Yirmiyah? No? Terem yitzarticha babeten, right? What does God say to Yirmiyah? Before I formed you in your mother's womb, yedaticha, no? Novi legoyim nesaticha, I made you a prophet for the goyim, for the nations. The Abarbanel says, talking about Plato. And the Abarbanel writes that God said to Yirmiyah, Novi legoyim nesaticha, that I made you a prophet for goyim, for the Gentiles, for the nations, he's talking about Plato. The Abarbanel says, because Plato was so influential in Western civilization, the philosopher Alfred Whitehead wrote that all of later philosophy is just footnotes to Plato. He was so influential that when God told Yirmiyah, Novi legoyim nesaticha, it means that he made him the Rebbe of Plato. So a lot of what Plato writes is very true in our writings. It's just the way that Augustine took it is where it got krum, where it got a little very crooked, and when things got messed up. But Plato said the famous parable of the cave. He said like this, imagine people that were born in a dim, dark, dungeon cave. People are born in a cave. They've never seen the outside world. He says, and they're chained up to a cave. They're chained up, they can never leave this cave. And being chained to the cave, what do they have all day? What could they do all day? What do they do all day? They look at the wall because the entrance to the cave has a little place where the light from the outside world could come in. And different figures, different creatures outside the cave walk by the entrance and form shadows on the wall. And so the people in the cave spend all their life looking at these shadows. Looking at the shadows. And they're very interesting. They're beautiful. They start move. The shadows move and take different shapes. And the people in the cave love those shadows. They're enamored with them, because that's what they see all day. And they start like writing poems about the shadows, and making paintings of the shadows, right? Till one day somebody runs into the cave and says, hey, what you're looking at is not reality. You're looking at the shadows. You have to see what's making those shadows. You have to go out of the cave and see what's passing by the entrance, that's the reality. What you're seeing is just some, you know, translucent projection of reality. That's not real. And the people in the cave mock him and scoff at him and say, what are you talking about? Look how beautiful these shadows are. Until finally, some of them have enough courage to leave the cave and see the real world. Says Plato, the Nimshel, everyone understands what the Nimshel, everyone understands what it's trying to say. Plato says that that's what a philosopher's job is. A philosopher's job is to come and say, the reality, the physical reality that we see is not real. It's just an emanation. It's just a representation. The real reality is what's called the realm of ideas. There's a transcendent realm of ideas, which is reflected as a physical world. I'll give you a very simple example. Let me ask you a question. This over here is a chair, right? This is a chair. And that's a chair. And that's a chair. But they're all different. Right? There are chairs in the Metropolitan Museum of Art that were formed in the, you know, in France 300 years ago that are worth like almost $1 million, right? And then you could take a couple of pieces of wood and make a chair. Which one is the real chair? What makes a chair if there's so many different types of chairs? What's the definition of a chair? Which is the real chair? The answer is none of them. Obviously, if they could be changed, they're mutable. And they could be represented in different ways, and they could be destroyed. So obviously none of them is the ultimate chair. The ultimate chair is not physical. The ultimate chair is in a supernal realm. There's an idea of chair. An ultimate spiritual chair. Which then emanates and becomes manifest in this world as a lot of different types of chairs. And what makes one chair nicer is that it has more chairness. Chairness is reflected more in that chair. But the real chair is not here. It's the spiritual chair, the ethereal chair. And by the way, it's not just a chair. Let's talk about something a lot more important. What is good? What does it mean to be good? What's good? Goodness. We all want to be good, right? So what's good? Helping an old lady across the street is good. Chocolate chip cookie is good. Right? Which is better? Which is better? Which is more good? A chocolate chip cookie helping an old lady across the street. Well, in order to be able to answer that, you have to first know what good is. To be able to know which one of them has more good. Right? So in order to know what real good is, you have to come to terms with what good is, divorced of anything physical. The idea of goodness. And that's his philosophy. And that became the philosophy. Plato wrote a whole book called The Republic, where he said that there's going to be a society of philosophers, those that are going to run into the cave and wake people up, that they're going to spend their lives trying to figure out what the good, what the real chair is, what the real good is. And the rest of the simple people will just sort of serve them. By the way, the sociologist Karl Popper has a book called The Open Society and Its Enemies. He was at the time of communism. The Karl Popper was very, you know, communism. They were afraid of the communists. He said that Plato was the original communist. Plato was the original communist, right? He was an elite. He was part of the aristocratic elite. And he said that the elite philosophers, those are the ones that really are going to be able to perceive and have a vision of this real good. By the way, later on, that became the church fathers, yeah? Those elite, that they're going to know what the good is. And some rabbis are like that too. They're going to know, a lot of the rabbis, they're going to know what the good is. They're going to have this perception of what good is, what a chair is. And then they're going to come and they're going to tell the rest of us that we should know. And that became a break, a complete idealistic break between the world that we see and everything else around us. And philosophy is that search, and people are going to spend their lives searching for that supernal realm of ideas, and to know that this world that you see is just a shadow. It's just an emanation. Now, anyone that learned any chassidus and knows about the 10 sfirot and the idea of that everything is the light of Hashem and Seder Ishtalshalus, the downchaining of worlds, it should ring bells, right? It sounds very familiar. It's not the same thing at all, but we don't have time to get into that tonight. Stay tuned. We're going to have to get to that later. But yes, it's very similar. What later became Neoplatonism. Neoplatonism was later a spiritual philosophical movement. It's very hard to know the difference between what Kabbalah teaches, what's said is in the Kabbalah, mysticism, and Neoplatonism. They're very similar. Most academics don't get it. They're very similar. It's not the same, but they're very similar. Came along Aristotle, the student of Plato, and he said no. He taught the immanent teleological process of the forms. He taught that the real reality is this world. He said it's not true. He said, you're right, Plato. There's a certain type of chair. There's an ultimate chair. But that ultimate chair is immanent in the world. We're going to speak about this more when we get to page 6. But there's what's called the meaning of, you all know the idea of tzura and chomer, matter and form. You all heard of matter and form, right? It's an Aristotelian concept. Aristotle introduced the differentiation between matter and form, and he taught form, what Aristotle called form, is essentially taking the concept of Plato of the idea and saying that the idea is inherent in the matter. The form of the matter is the idea. And came along Aristotle, and you know, part of Aristotle's philosophy is zoology. Aristotle came and taught that each thing is specific in nature, everything is part of the world itself, to the extent that you have to study zoology. If you read Aristotle's book, sometimes you don't know if you're reading philosophy or like, you know, biology. Because according to Aristotle, biology is part of philosophy. Because no, we have to study the actual things themselves, because ultimate reality is this physical world. You've all heard of Martin Luther, right? I don't mean Martin Luther King, the first Martin Luther. Now, we're not fans of him. He was a very devious person in many ways. But he said an interesting thing. He said, the three greatest enemies that there are against God and religion are the devil, the Pope, he was Martin Luther, right? He's a Protestant. The devil, the Pope, and Aristotle. Those are the three greatest enemies of religion. Aristotle is an enemy of religion, because Aristotle came and said, one has to only learn and study what's imminent within the world. This debate between Plato and Aristotle went on, and again, it could be seen throughout history. All those, you know, you could almost say that all those that espoused, you know, the seeking of poetry and the seeking of theology and beauty and spirituality are those students of Plato, and empiricism and science and technology, those are all students of Aristotle. Came along Augustine and cemented that when he wrote City of God, and he said Plato was right, and not only was Plato right, but this rift, this split between heaven and earth, between the two realms of the city of God and the city of man, not only was Plato right, but you're ready for this. In order to have a portion in the world to come, you have to be a Platonist and not Aristotelian. From now on, it wasn't just a debate in philosophy. You know, Plato and Aristotle were not, they were not preaching religion. Augustine came and said that just like God is establishing his city in a spiritual realm, this Platonic realm of ideas of which the world is only an emanation, to be able to be part, to have this eternal reward, you have to believe in that city of God. You have to shun the world and not be aware, not study the world. Aristotle's focus on the world and physicality, said Martin Luther, is the biggest enemy against religion. And therefore, you understand, listen carefully, context. Later on at the time of the Renaissance, really began in the Middle Ages, I don't have time to get into it, but that's why it was so revolutionary when Aquinas and Abelard by the Christians and the Rambam by us and by the Muslim scholars, when they started talking Aristotle in the 12th century, it was very revolutionary. They, all of a sudden it was like, it's like almost using, you know, an iPhone to listen to a shir. When they started using Aristotle to prove religion, to prove monotheism, it was a revolutionary thing. Aristotle? What is that? Aristotle is the Shagids. Plato is, you know, the Tzaddik. But when that happened, there remained in people's minds that there's a debate between, Augustine said, there's a debate between science and religion. You have to take one, you have to be part of one realm or the other. That's a purely Christian concept. Judaism doesn't believe in that. We never did. We never did. Judaism, and you, I don't have to explain this to you, you all know this already. Judaism says God swore that he won't enter the Jerusalem down below before he enters the Jerusalem above. Of course there are two realms. But which is the most important realm in God's eyes? Hashemayim u'shmei Hashemayim lo yechal kalucha. What did King Solomon say when he saw the cloud of God enter the tabernacle, enter the Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, right? The Book of Kings. What did Shlomo HaMelech say? The heaven and the heavens can't contain the infinite light of Hashem. Afki abayis hazeh. But yet he saw with his prophecy the infinite light of God contracting itself within the Beis HaMikdash, within the temple. Of course there are two realms. But in our religion, we say the most important one is over here. But you have to understand, it became prevalent in all of society that there's a debate, there's this conflict, this irresolvable conflict between city of God and city of man. You can't be a citizen of both. And all the philosophers and the historians, they were writing that there's this, and by the way, the church strengthened it all the time. That's why there was this thinking that there has to be, you have to be focused on the heaven and can't be focused on the earth. And therefore, listen carefully, when people tell you, listen carefully, that there was an age of reason and an age of faith. I'm sure you've heard that, right? There was the age of faith, the dark ages. Those that were at the time of religion was an age of faith. And now, since the Renaissance, since the Enlightenment, we're now in the age of reason. Right? That's what people say, right? It's a pet peeve of mine. It's baloney. It's not age of reason and age of faith. I call it age of reason and age of eyes. Eyes. Meaning, do you really think that theology, those that believe in God and those that believe in religion, are not using their brains? Science, especially the way that science is preached today, has nothing to do with brain. I mean, obviously they have brains. I'm not saying they're brain dead, yeah? Obviously they're geniuses. But the scientific method and what modern man has been completely captivated by was being convinced utterly convinced that what cannot be observed empirically does not exist. It's nothing to do with faith or reason. There are a lot of issues. I'm not debating the fact that there are a lot of issues that science has that seem to pose questions to what Torah says. Whether it's dinosaurs or the age of the universe or whether we're heliocentric or geocentric, whether the Earth goes around the sun and the sun goes around the Earth. I'm not going to get into all those different things. But you all know everything has answers. I know, let me rephrase that. There are ways to answer all of those challenges that science poses to Torah. Are they conclusive? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There are no conclusive answers to anything. Nothing. You cannot prove anything conclusively, empirically. Impossible. Nobody knows really anything about the truth of reality, conclusively, that you could observe with your eyes. And therefore, what essentially today, the stress that's going on, there's this psychological thinking that science and religion are two different things, because the city of God or the city of man. You have to either buy into what the scientists are saying, or you have to buy into what the theologians are saying. And then we've inherited, since the time of the Enlightenment, and then later on the scientific method became so prevalent that people are used to saying, it's not about reason, their brains. People that believe in theology use their minds. Today, modern man thinks, if I can't see it, it's not real. You can't prove. You know what people say to me? Prove to me God exists. So you could tell them 15 proofs. None of them are conclusive, of course not, because everything could be debated one way or the other. So how do you want to be proved? I could see, if I could see it. That's like people, the only way that people will believe things today, if I could see it. And therefore, you all know, it wasn't just reason and faith that was challenged. Reason was challenged. I'm sorry, it wasn't just faith and religion that was challenged. Reason, it's not the age of reason anymore, it's the age of eyes. People don't believe in the brain either. We spoke a little about, from the time of Immanuel Kant, the critique of pure reason, and those philosophers after him, they also said, remember we spoke about, they said today we could only study phenomenology. You can no longer be a part of, there's no such thing anymore of ontology or even epistemology. Because he already said the mind can't perceive anything, things in themselves. We can only know our subjective experience. So you can't even trust the brain anymore. And that and therefore, essentially, what modern man is facing is a crisis of that you can't know anything, not just you can't believe in anything, you can't even trust your own brain. And that brought about, essentially, what about is you can't have faith in anything. You can't trust anything anymore. Nothing exists anymore, except what makes you feel good. That brought about the 60s. That brought about modern art. That brought about the chaos of the world. There was a philosopher, to the extent that the existentialist, you had a philosopher called Albert Camus. Albert Camus, a great French philosopher, who was inherited, you know, this new outlook of man that we can't trust the brain, Kant destroyed the mind, we can't trust faith, because there's this split between heaven and earth. So I can't know anything. I can't believe in anything. So he has a whole book, Camus, about why should I not commit suicide? I'm not joking. If you're not, he has a book, The Myth of Sisyphus, has a whole book, a philosophical question, why should I not commit suicide? Unless you're just happy enough and you're okay just to spend your life enjoying yourself, then what, there's absolutely no purpose. I can't know any purpose. And that became the chaos of modern man and all the what we're going through to this very day. What I'm trying to explain over here, we have to understand, there's no debate, there's no conflict between science and religion. There might be a conflict between empirical observation and religion. There might be a debate between what I could empirically observe with my eyes and religion, but you know what? There's a debate between that and anything else, any truism, any philosophy, any ideology. You can't prove that you even have a mind. You can't prove that you know anything. And if you proof is considered what I could empirically observe, if that's the standard of what proof is. So anyone that says to you, I can't believe in God because of the dinosaurs. I can't believe in God because X, Y, and Z. It's a waste of time to try to explain to them what the answers are to that. There are answers to that. Are they conclusive? No. You have to first say to them, tell me, what do you consider proof? What do you consider proof? you have to be able to see it, forget it. Commit suicide. Might as well. Or spend your nights in the house of the rising sun. One or the other. That's your choices, right? Because if only what you could see with your eyes is real, then you can't really believe in anything. So therefore, I want you to understand where Rav Soloveitchik here is going to, when we're going to be discussing over the next couple of weeks, scientific man, vis-a-vis religious man, we're not talking about an atheist and a believer. We're talking about two outlooks. We have to reprogram ourselves, context, reprogram ourselves to understand that there's no debate between science and religion. There's no, it's two different outlooks. It's a Platonic outlook, an Aristotelian outlook, or we could even say a Hasidish and a Masnagish outlook, however you want to say it. There are different ways of looking at things. What the focus is, we're going to learn about. But it's not a debate. There's no tension there. I mean, there's a tension, but it's not a tension that you have to either stop wearing tzitzis. Right? It's a tension to know what should be my, remember what we spoke about 2 weeks ago, what should be my phenomenological experience? How should I live life? What should my focus be? What should be my perception of reality? That's what he's discussing over here. And that's very important to bear in mind. Okay. Let's read inside. That was just the first sentence. Sorry. So let's read inside. Halachic man reflects two opposing selves. Two disparate images are embodied within his soul and spirit. On the one hand, he is as far removed from religious man, homo religiosus, as East is from West, and is identical in many respects to prosaic cognitive man. On the other hand, he is a man of God, possessor of an ontological approach that is devoted to God and of a worldview saturated with the radiance of the divine presence. For this reason, it is difficult to analyze halachic man's religious consciousness. What are we trying to analyze here, right? What's this whole book about? Bear it in mind. His religious consciousness, right? Remember we spoke about? What are we learning here? We're learning how to reprogram our consciousness, our phenomenology, our perception. And we want to understand halachic man's phenomenological experience. How does he live his life? What's his modus operandi? What's the way that he looks at reality? But he's saying that it's difficult to analyze halachic man's religious consciousness by applying the terms and traits that descriptive psychology and modern philosophy of religion have used to characterize the religious personality. Usually we have a whole bunch of descriptions that modern philosophers, that psychologists, how they explain religious people, right? It's actually really what Rav Soloveitchik is, his idea of writing Halachic Man is really applying an idea that began with William James. William James was a famous psychologist, an American psychologist at the beginning of the 20th century. He took this idea of the phenomenology that knew, remember, the Kantian turn to the subject. And William James was the first one to actually begin analyzing, anyone know the name of his famous book? The varieties of religious experience. Remember, what we're learning about here is how we should be experiencing God. Religious experience, right? It's not. We're learning over here about not just what to do. Being orthodox is not just about what you're supposed to do with your hands. It's about, remember we spoke about, it's how to live one's life in one's mind. And here are the varieties of religious experience where he focused on, he took note, and he characterized and he formulated ways of understanding what is religious experience. What does it mean to experience religion? Rav Soloveitchik is coming and now looking from a Jewish perspective. Okay, William James came along and he taught us what it means. What is religious experience? But now we have to see from a Jewish perspective. But the problem, Rav Soloveitchik is saying, is that all those things that the philosophers and the psychologists wrote to try to analyze what the religious experience is from a secular perspective or from a Gentile perspective, and does not have the tools to understand a halachic man. Why? Why? Because halachic man, listen carefully, is not just what? He's not just religious man. What else does he have within him? Cognitive man. He is a fusion. He is a fusion of these two different types of the religious man and the scientific man. And it's a whole new way of looking at things. Now, here I have to say something very important. I'm going to say it now, I'm going to repeat it again when we get to chapter 5. Okay? We spoke about that Rav Soloveitchik grew up with a Chabad Tudor. His whole outlook, the way that he formed his mind and his perception of reality was through his tutors that were Hasidim, Chabad Hasidim. In this book, Religious Man is really a portrayal of the way that he sees Chabad Hasidism. Almost every time when he quotes, when he brings and he speaks about Religious Man, that perspective, that outlook of Religious Man as opposed to Cognitive and Prosaic Man, right? He quotes from the Alter Rebbe. He quotes from the Alter Rebbe. He quotes from Chassidus. That's who Religious Man is. You understand already why, right? Think for a second. If we're speaking about Religious Man as opposed to Scientific Man as being what? Plato and Aristotle. Plato sounds like Kabbalah. And his, Rav Soloveitchik's experience and his knowledge of Kabbalah came from Chabad Chassidism. And therefore, he's writing a whole book, really, you could say, to analyze the difference between a misnagid and a chassid. The phenomenology, the experience, the religious experience in the mind, what does it mean to experience life and the world in religion as a chassid? And what does it mean to experience it as a misnagid? Or what does it mean to experience it as a person that's firmly focused on science, on empirical reality? The only thing is, and here I'm going to have to ask Mechila. I mean, Soloveitchik was, of course, don't come up to his heels. But Rav Soloveitchik in this book makes one big mistake that a lot of people that study Chabad Hasidism make, that mistake where they misinterpret what Chabad Hasidism is saying. So when we speak of what we're going to learn about, when Rav Soloveitchik is going to make this differentiation between religious man and halachic man, really, the way Chabad Hasidism looks at the world and the other schools of Hasidic thought look at the world have that same tension. And the way Rav Soloveitchik defines halachic man is really the way that Chabad would agree with. Now it's going to be very interesting. We're going to see. I'm going to learn with you also. We're going to go through texts. The way that there was, you all know that the Alter Rebbe, within the schools of Hasidism, there was a debate between the Alter Rebbe and the other students of the Magid of Mizrich, right? The tension inherent today between Lubavitch and the other schools of Hasidism really are direct outcomes from the tension that the Alter Rebbe had with the other tzaddik and the students of the Magid. And they come from two different ways of looking at Teresa Baal Shem Tov. I'm just going to say now, because I don't want you to lose sleep. I'd feel bad. I don't want anyone, the spouse is calling me up at night. That made them lose sleep. But just very quickly, do we say that the ultimate, what's ultimate avodas Hashem? What does it mean to be a true servant of Hashem? To completely raise oneself out of the physical realm and take part in the transcendent part Hashem. And that's the ultimate, not to be part of this world, or to draw God down here. That difference is going to be the difference between these schools, religious man and halachic man. And we're going to see Mitzvah. Okay, I want to just read a little more, a couple of more minutes. Let's read another paragraph. The image that halachic man presents is singular, even strange. He is of a type that is unfamiliar to students of religion, because no one's ever, before Rav Soloveitchik, no one wrote about the experience, the philosophical experience of Judaism. To understand, to appreciate what Rav Soloveitchik is doing, he's the first one. A lot of people know Rav Soloveitchik was a great man, but to understand what he's doing in this book, he was the first one to analyze with philosophical terms the experiential life of what a Jew is supposed to live. So he's saying it's unfamiliar. It's strange. It's unfamiliar to students of religion until this book, right? But if in the light of modern philosophy, homo religiosus in general has come to be regarded as an antithetical being, fraught with contradictions, who wrestles with his consciousness and struggles with the tribulations of the dualism of affirmation and negation, approbation and denigration. We're going to explain all of this. How much more so is this true of halachic man? We're going to explain all of this, Mitzvah Shem, next week, because it's very important. But let me just summarize what he's saying over here. One thing we know about religious man. One thing has been firmly established that we do know about religious man. That what? He lives with strife. He lives with tribulations and he lives with having to wrestle and struggle. You all understand, listen carefully, that when Yaakov Avinu, how did Jacob get the name Yisrael? By fighting with Esav through a struggle that is the story of all our lives. To be a Yisrael, to go from a Yaakov, a heel, to being a Yisrael, one has to struggle with that inherent fight, that tribulation, that strife within ourselves. I'll tell you a beautiful idea. And with this we'll finish, Mr. Shem, and next week we'll explain. A beautiful idea from the Munkacher Rebbe, from the Michel Saluzim. And this idea that I've always, throughout my life, has been one of those things that I've taken out of my pocket when I needed, those energy drink things? You know what I'm talking about? You know, it's things that if you drink it at night, you're like a fish that your eyes don't shut. You have your eyes open, like, you know. Actually, one time I was driving, I had to drive in the middle of the night, so I had three of those energy drinks. I didn't sleep for like the next 48 hours. So this idea has been an energy drink in my life, so I'm going to share it with you. It's one of the things to pull out once in a while. The Munkacher Rebbe says like this. You all remember from chapter 27 of Tehillim, Nodav Roshamay Rishi, we spend the whole Elul and a lot of Tishrei saying it, right? Im tachane ole machane loy yira libi. Im tokum alay melchama bezoy sani beteach. If a camp, a whole camp of the enemy sets up its fort against me, lo yir libi, my heart shall not be afraid. Im tokum alay melchama, if a war, a whole battle is waged against me, not only won't they be afraid, what are the words? Bezois ani beteach. In this, I trust. I put my faith, right? So the Munkacher Rebbe said an unbelievable thing. Michel Saluzim said, if you're living a life that in your daily life, you're fighting battles, you feel that there's a whole enemy camp against you. You feel that there are whole soldiers and armies fighting against you and constantly challenging you. Your heart shouldn't be afraid. You know why? It shows that you're on the right path. It shows you that you're a servant of Hashem. Because Tzadik V'Ra'le and Rosh HaVetov Lo'i is in Ruchnius, not just in Gashmius. The Munkacher Rebbe said, those that have it easy in spiritual lives, those are the people that are not trying to serve Hashem. That's Rosh HaVetov Lo'i is not in Gashmius. When we speak about a person that has it good and physically, he seems to be, that's talking about him in the Avodas Hashem. Those that try to be the tzaddikim, those that try to get closer to Hashem, are the ones that are going to have enemy armies setting up camp against you. Im tokum alay melchama, if a battle, a war comes against me, b'zoy sani b'teach. That is my assurance that what? That I could trust that what? That I'm doing okay. If I have to fight, if I have to struggle, if I'm, how does Rav Soloveitchik say? If I'm an antithetical being, fraught with contradictions, wrestling with my consciousness, then you're an Oved Hashem. Then you're an Oved Hashem. And Rav Soloveitchik says that's the universal home religiosus. Halachic man is even worse. That's anyone. Anyone that's a religious person has to deal with the Bezoi Sani Beteach. We have to know, Bezoi Sani Beteach. Halachic man is even more of a challenge. We're going to talk about next week, Mitzvah Shem. Sure. Sounds weird from here.
In this place. Hi. Anytime we talked about the dark ages, I remember from middle school, we were always talking about all the plagues.
Uh-huh.
So I just wanted to mention that it wasn't only that there was this philosophical shift that was so on, but it was also a huge percentage of the population died.
And what do you mean? What are you saying that in reference to?